Hi there. Welcome to Abounding Grace online at agradio.org. We've just finished up our series on the Ten Commandments. And before we head into a brand new series looking at the book of Hebrews, we thought we'd start the week off with some in-studio time with Pastor Chris Gordon. Pastor Chris's guest today is no stranger to the program and no stranger to the ministry at Escondido URC. He is the past professor of church history and past president of Westminster Seminary. Dr. W. Robert Godfrey joins us in studio today. He's just wrapped up a series, a Sunday school series, here at Escondido URC, taking a look at the end of Christendom in America. Now that is the short title. He's got a longer one he'll explore and we'll explain. So if you'll take a moment, join us. Pastor Chris now in studio with our guest, Dr. W. Robert Godfrey.
You did a wonderful class. This is, you know, I'm your pastor, so I keep you in check, right?
That's right. I always refer to him as Dominie Gordon.
Yes.
For the uninformed, that means minister in Dutch, so I still revere him.
So we're trying to be somewhat professional here without joking around too much, but...
I wouldn't say that.
You did an excellent series for the Escondido United Reformed Church on the end of Christendom. What was it? Sex, race, politics, and power. What's going on right now? Wasn't that the...
Yeah, that was the come-on title to try to get people to actually attend the class. I didn't feel end of Christendom had a lot of appeal.
That's true. That's true. It was a very helpful series, and we're really grateful that you took time to do that here. I know it was a great blessing to the church, and we've posted these on Abounding Grace Radio, so we've had a lot of downloads and a lot of people listening to it. I guess I thought it might be helpful to have you on, Bob, just to kind of recap a little bit and talk about the series and what brought you to this place. So the thesis is
yes.
That Christendom has ended in America. Is that right?
Right.
And this has received a lot of attention, I think, because it's really helped us to see the larger picture of what's happening. You provided a category for people to kind of process this. So maybe you can recap for us your thesis up front here. And for those who haven't listened to the 17 lectures, they should. 17, did you know that?
Yeah, that sounds like a lot. I'm feeling sleepy.
And let me say, it wasn't really a classroom. I thought you did a really good job of kind of balancing. I mean, it's a church Sunday school class. How deep can you really go in a Sunday school class with the time that you have? But I thought you did a really good job of balancing what a Sunday school class is as opposed to a lecture in a classroom.
And knowing that people aren't there every week, you have to do a lot of recapitulation.
Right, right. So why is your thesis so important, and what led you to come to this conclusion?
Well, I became increasingly aware of the disorientation a lot of Christians were feeling about the current state of American society and culture that surrounded them, and how they felt not only disoriented but really confused about why attitudes and values seemed to have shifted so dramatically in what seemed to be a very short space of time. And as a historian, it led me to try to step back. One of the advantages I had teaching at a relatively small seminary was that I taught all of church history at one time or another. So I've had a long view of the history of the church. And it got me thinking why this sense of confusion, disorientation, why this dramatic sense of change. Now, pundits are always talking about change. And as a historian, often you sit back and think, there's not as much change as they think they are. They're always talking about these are the best of times, these are the worst of times. And that's seldom actually true. But as I thought about it, trying to be a historian, I thought this really is a time of dramatic change beyond most of what we've experienced. And then I tried to ask myself, what is the character of that change? It's not that overnight there are fewer Christians than there used to be. That's not the reality. There were probably never as many Christians as we like to hope there were. But nonetheless, there's still plenty of churches. There are plenty of well-attended churches. There are plenty of faithful churches. There are lots of Christians in America. What has changed so dramatically? And that's where I came up with this idea that it's not the end of Christianity by any means, but it's the end of what I was calling Christendom.
And you saw, and at least you made, I think it was the first class, or maybe it was the second class, you kind of kept us waiting as to what was one of those pivotal events that marked that for you. And I thought it was helpful because you said it wasn't so much the Supreme Court decision, it was the response of the masses and even Christians to the decision. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? I thought that was a really good point.
Right. In 2015, which is just 7 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that gay marriage had to be legal in America. And I tried to argue in the class, it was not that decision that ended Christendom, but the end of Christendom in my mind was marked, signaled by the reaction to that decision. So instead of many voices raised in opposition, many organizations formed to get that decision overturned, very widely in America, there was just a sort of shrugging of the shoulders. Okay, that's a, you know, I wouldn't have made that decision. I'm not really in favor of that decision, some people would say. But, you know, life goes on. Nothing really changes. And what that signaled to me is that whereas for 1,000 years and more in the West, certain Christian values had been the fallback position of most people, whether they were really Christians in their hearts or not, and the character of marriage was one of those fallback, commonly held virtues, all of a sudden that's changed, and people can just shrug. Right. And I guess it came home to me because I heard on some news outlet a discussion of the fact that one county clerk in Kansas or Kentucky had refused to issue a marriage license to a gay couple. And said, isn't that shocking that she wouldn't obey the law? And the other guy said, I think it's more shocking that there was only one. Mm-hmm. And that's what really got me thinking. Everybody is just going along with this decision as if it's kind of perfectly normal.
Right.
Such a contrast with the decision about abortion, 50 years earlier. And part of it, of course, is abortion involves an unborn child, and so it's clearly not a purely individual matter. And I think what happened to Americans is they've become radical individualists, so if two people want to get married, what do I care? It doesn't affect me. And but that meant that fallback fundamental Christian values that had guided the West for closer to 1,500 years, really, suddenly no longer applied. And they haven't applied really in a long time. They cease to apply to divorce. They cease to apply to premarital sex. They cease to apply to homosexuality generally. And now all of a sudden, on the matter of marriage, people just shrug and go on. It's because Christian values no longer, in the Christendom sense, in the legal, cultural, dominant sense, have died.
Right.
And now we see that you know, being manifested in all sorts of ways in the 7 years that have passed, Christian values on these questions now have come to be regarded as bigoted and hostile and evil. So to say that you agreed with 1,500 years of Western history that have been overturned for 7 years now makes you a bigot. And
right. Which shows the shift from postmodernism to kind of anti-Christian. You know, we would say it was a postmodern time. People had their views and you could hold to your view. Now it's anti-Christian. It's opposed to what was embedded in cultural law and influence in Christendom.
Right. That the postmodernists say, you can't criticize my point of view because we're all entitled to our point of view and no point of view is more valuable than another point of view. But yeah, all of that has changed. To what some people have called a new kind of Puritanism, probably that's a label totally unfair to the Puritans,
right.
But it's really a new kind of Marxism.
Yeah.
Marxists always knew what was true, and they were going to impose it on everybody else, and that's what we're experiencing now.
Right, and how fast everything's moving, which was kind of a strange thing, that since the time you taught the Sunday school class to now, look at the decision of the Supreme Court regarding Roe v. Wade. Maybe some would stand back and say, well, wait a minute, maybe we're saving Christendom. Well, how did you respond
to
that?
You know, my first reaction, and I always have weird reactions. My first reaction to Roe v. Wade was, we all need to pray that this actually reduces the number of abortions in America.
Right.
And I think we're seeing already that lots of people who signed on to be pro-life as long as it didn't cost anything and as long as it wasn't actually likely to come into law, now suddenly aren't so very pro-life. And all over the country, states are talking about introducing laws that are going to allow abortion at a much later stage of pregnancy than has been true in this country. And yeah, I continue fearful that the number of abortions will rise because there is no Christendom consensus to say that the life of the unborn is important at any stage of pregnancy.
Right, right. So what I'd like to kind of, before we get to some of the figures that you talked about in the series, I guess I think sort of the lingering question that was all throughout the series that you were really building to answer toward the end, but I think we'll get there early in this talk. So how do you, let's start with this. Where do you see the church today and how we are handling this? I'm thinking here of responses and are we being helpful in response? And I'll follow up with that in a minute with some of the responses that I'm seeing in the church today. But where do you think we are? How are we doing in response?
Well, I think one of the problematics that America, it seems to me, has faced in its religious life for 200 years is this great push to evangelize, which, of course, in itself is a good thing, the great push to have vital religion, experiential religion. And in and of itself, properly defined, that's a good thing. But the result has been the movement that today we know of as evangelicalism, a movement which is very tempted always to emphasize what it would call Christian fundamentals or Christian basics, and not to press too hard on other things that might compromise evangelism. And so it's a form of religion that wants to make, in many ways, Christianity easier for people. And again, you can understand the motive. You can even approve of the motive to a certain extent. But the question then for evangelicals comes, and we see that as evangelicalism is kind of breaking into a progressive wing and a conservative wing, is what things are negotiable. And certain surveys have showed that amongst members of evangelical churches in America, the divorce rate is about as high as the divorce rate in the culture generally. So evangelical churches may pay some lip service to the biblical teaching on divorce, but they're not enforcing it very much. And so what we're going to see over time is how much are the evangelicals going to be willing to go along with the changing cultural perspectives. We've already seen that with the ordination of women. There are progressive evangelicals that are all in favor of the ordination of women, even though, speaking as one on the conservative side, the biblical case against the ordination of women seems pretty strong and pretty clear. So we're living in a, there certainly are many churches that are continuing to uphold biblical values. And we're hearing that from the pulpit. We're hearing that in congregational study groups. The question will be, how do we carry that out of the church and into the culture and make that part of our public witness? And what happens to us then?
Right. So to follow up with that, so there really are different kinds of responses. You mentioned really the compromised response that will fall into these ideologies and embrace them in Christianity, which will essentially, I mean, this is Machen revisited in many ways.
Right.
But there's also the retreatist, disengaged response.
Right. We could call it the Amish response.
Amish response. And then there's the other, which I think you touched on somewhat in the class. You didn't think coming today I'd throw these heavy questions at you, did you?
Sure.
This would be a light discussion.
Yeah, no, this is fun.
All right. The other being what I see as the reclaim Christendom response found right now in the great rise of post-mill reconstructive theonomic efforts, which I was reading a book you edited years ago on theonomy or reform critique, and it seems to me that now this is really, again, in vogue. That was about, 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah.
Right. So what are the dangers in each of these sort of responses? You already touched on the sort of compromise. We'll come back to that. And now after 250 years, we didn't seem to bring in the golden age in America. You'd think we would have accomplished it, but we didn't quite get where we wanted to get if this is the outcome. So
we haven't even been able to do it in Western Michigan or Northwest Iowa. I mean,
can we do it now is my question. And how realistic can we be of what can be accomplished in this life, especially now that we've come into this sort of anti-Christian culture?
Well, there is a broad movement that we could call, I suppose, broadly Reconstructionism, or sometimes being called Dominion theology. The idea that Christians ought to exercise dominion and they will exercise dominion, that's linked to the postmillennial eschatology. So even though there's no evidence that Christians are about to exercise dominion, in fact, faithful Christianity seems to be on decline in terms of cultural influence,
right,
at least.
Right.
There is this optimism, there is this confidence built on postmillennial eschatology. Now, personally, I've always hoped the postmills are right.
yeah, wouldn't that be great?
I just am not persuaded out of the Bible that it's true. And there are certainly good postmillennialists who don't share the broader Reconstructionist agenda. The most concerning element of the Reconstructionist or Dominion agenda is their willingness, it seems to me, to coerce others to go along with their point of view. And in looking at the history of Christendom, I've become increasingly convinced that it was precisely the willingness to be coercive that created Christendom, but also led to its demise, and in the process, distorted Christianity.
Right.
I think it's very hard to find a word in the teaching of Jesus or Paul that calls for Christians to be coercive in forcing their views on others.
Right. And, local Christian school mottos and the Crusaders it's all embedded there in our thinking from the past, right?
Right. And, there's the very fair question of if we think something is a matter of justice, protecting the unborn.
Sure.
Yeah, we may be involved in trying to see laws passed that would be coercive of people to be just. But I don't want to speak for anybody else. I don't want to see laws in any way coercing anyone to be a Christian or to go to church or believe any particular theology. I think Jesus and the apostles were committed to persuasion on those matters.
Right.
And I think we have a good case to make. But I think it's harder to get people to listen if they feel they're being forced into something.
Right. And I think the sort of response to that would be, okay, how do we not end up in the sort of retreatist response where we just huddle together in our groups and do nothing? So you've kind of addressed the compromised and then the reclaim Christendom goals and pursuits. But what about that thought?
Well, that's where in the class I talked about Abraham Kuyper, who was a remarkable Dutch minister, theologian, who became a politician and ultimately prime minister in the Netherlands, a very faithful Reformed fellow, a very creative thinker, who I felt recognized already in the late 19th century that Christendom was coming to an end, and raised the very modern Christian question of what then for us as Christians, and specifically rejected self-consciously rejected both an effort to recreate Christendom, which some Reformed Christians in the Netherlands wanted to do, and rejected the withdrawal model, which some Reformed Christians in the Netherlands tended to do, and said instead there needs to be a public voice of Christians, not of the institutional church, but of Christians to try to advance certain political and cultural aims in the name of Christianity, but on the basis of persuading the body politic to support these goals. And for Kuiper, in his day, one of the great issues was public tax support for Christian schools. And that was a really interesting issue because it brought together a number of broad cultural concerns. To whom do children belong? Do they belong to the state? Do they belong to the church? Or do they belong to the family? The rising leftist philosophy, whether Marxist or just secularist in the 19th century, increasingly saw children belonging to the state. And Kuiper utterly rejected that, said they belong to the family. God gives children to families. Families have the responsibility to educate their children. And if the state says children have to be educated to a certain level, then the state ought to give money to the parents to see that that happens according to the vision, the religious vision of parents. So in a certain sense, Kuiper was very liberal. He said reform parents ought to be able to build reform schools, but Catholic parents ought to be able to build Catholic schools. Jewish parents ought to be able to build Jewish schools. Secular parents ought to be able to build secular schools so that their children can be nourished in the convictions of the family.
Yeah. It is interesting right now in response to everything that's happening. I think it was Al Mohler on his report today was saying there is a positive here. Parents are showing themselves and demonstrating themselves to be very protective over the education of their children
right
now. We're seeing that. I think Arizona even passed something similar to what you described, giving public funding to Christians who want to send their kids to wherever they want to send them.
Right. I mean, we've seen that for several decades with the growth of the homeschooling movement. That was parents taking back control. In Dutch Reform circles, the commitment to Christian day schools has been a very long-standing reality. That's true of a lot of confessional Lutherans and Roman Catholics as well. So, there is this desire to ensure that schooling reflects parental concerns, and we've even seen that in the Virginia gubernatorial election, where parents are trying to have more influence in the public school. And it's interesting to see the pushback. If parents claim a right to influence public school policy, there have been voices saying they're terrorists or they're fanatics or they're bigots. Why are parental voices suddenly irrelevant to the setting of public school policy? If not the parents, then who's going to do that? Right. School boards? What competence or authority do they have? And we all know that too often school boards are instruments of unions or other kinds of influences in society that are not reflecting the interests of parents.
But I do appreciate, I appreciated this in the class, your emphasis that parents, and it comes through education, we need to take very seriously as Christians how our children are educated. And I think that's a really good response in the midst of all of this. And one way that we can respond is to ensure that we're providing that for the next generation.
Right, because one of the things that Kuiper really attacked was the notion that there's this big secular sphere that's really neutral. And Kuiper insisted all of life is religious. So education is inevitably, unavoidably religious in character. It's just a matter of what religion's going to dominate. And what he wanted to resist was a sort of lack of awareness that secularism is itself a kind of religion.
Fascinating, isn't it? And it was indeed a fascinating Sunday school series that Dr. W. Robert Godfrey presented here at Escondido URC. And we still have more of that conversation with Pastor Chris Gordon to continue, and we'll do so next time.
This is Abounding Grace with Pastor Chris Gordon. Just enough time to leave you with our contact information. We'd love to hear from you. It's always a delight knowing you're being blessed by this radio program. Reach out to us at our website, agradio.org. Questions@agradio.org. If you wish to email us any questions you might have or praise reports, comments about the program. Or give us a call, 888-504-8805. By the way, when you visit our website, agradio.org, tons of resource material for you to tap into, as well as links to our other platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Again, all at agradio.org. And that phone number, once again, is 888-504-8805. Looking to write to us? If you're old school, the address for your envelope is Abounding Grace Radio, P.O. Box 732, Linden, Washington. The zip code is 98264. Hey, thanks for joining us today. Until next time, God bless. Abounding Grace is brought to you on this radio station by Abounding Grace Radio Ministries.
Hi, this is Chris Gordon, pastor of the Escondido United Reformed Church. I'd like to invite you to our Sunday worship services at 9:30 a.m. and 5 o'clock p.m. on Sunday. We have two worship services, 9:30 a.m. and 5 o'clock p.m. We preach Christ and Him crucified with the goal that you would live in the joy of this comfort in the knowledge of the forgiveness of all of your sins. 1864 North Broadway is the address here in Escondido. We'd love to see you this Sunday.